Writing for audio drama. Man starts up lawnmower. Fade to conversation about writing audio drama. All right, welcome once again to a writing in audio drama segment. This is Brian Lincoln, and I want to periodically have these conversations about writing in audio drama. Today's topic, I wanted to talk with people about adaptation. It's a very relevant topic. Some stuff has come out from our community that's been adaptive, and there definitely is some stuff in the works, as our two guests today will tell you all about. Let me first introduce Jay Smith. Jay is a guy I've worked with for years and years. We worked on HG World together. We did Hidden Harbor Mysteries together. It was a blast. I respect Jay a lot as a writer, so I expect to ask him on this segment quite often. Jay's doing an adaptive work right now. It's in progress. So, Jay, what can you tell them a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm excited to be part of an audio drama group called Wonder Thing, which is headed up by our mutual friend, Dave Robison. Dave is tied to a larger concern called Under Librum, which is a publishing consortium company, whatever you want to call it, run by a fantasy author, Ed Greenwood. And Ed has come up with 15 different worlds, and he's invited a lot of artists and writers, producers to contribute stories and characters and work together to realize these worlds. Dave's contribution is to create a group of audio dramatists to either adapt or create original work based on these 15 different worlds across different genres. My opportunity was to take Ed Greenwood's inaugural novel, very subtly titled Your World is Doomed, and adapt it for audio drama.
So you're actively in that process right now?
Yeah, I just had a green light from Ed on my structure, my plotting of his novel. He was very happy to see what we came up with in terms of fleshing out his characters mm-hmm. and restructuring it for the mind's eye as opposed to the book readers.
Cool. And let me move on to our other guests. So before we get too far into it, our other contributor here is Chris Jarvis. Hi, Chris.
Hi there.
So Chris is also adapting something. You're adapting a video game universe, right?
Yeah. I suppose my projects always seem to involve adaptation of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm really into, because I'm a gamer and because I've always found gaming as being something that's always kind of driven my imagination, I originally got involved in an Elite Dangerous fan series. So I was taking stuff to do with the new Elite game and kind of converting it into an audio sci-fi serial. It was a little bit difficult at the beginning because actually when I started the series, it was about 18 months before the game even went into alpha. So a lot of it was actually based on, you know, the previous games in the series. So Elite from 1984 and Frontier Elite 2 from 1992. I'm also involved in an adaptation of Chaos Reborn, which is a game recently out by Julian Gollop. We successfully kickstarted to get, I've sort of got a budget for 150% of an episode. So mm-hmm. I'm still working out whether that's going to be one or two episodes. And that's adapting what is basically a fantasy world with quite a rich backstory and history, and there's actually some world building going on with a guy who's a kind of long-time writing collaborator with me. And I'm also the third project, which is sort of a little bit in limbo, unfortunately for legal reasons, is an adaptation of his Elite novel. Mm-hmm. So he wrote an Elite novel, came to me and said, can you adapt it for audio drama? And that's something that I actually took his book and turned it into a recording script for audio drama. And that's, you know, that's tied up a little bit, unfortunately, in some legal processes. But hopefully that will see the light of day soon.
So there's got to be different considerations for those kinds of projects. Because for one, if you go from a novel, then you kind of have your plot laid out. And it's a matter of figuring out how much detail you can have, but if it's coming from just a generic universe, you can pretty much do anything, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think certainly the approach I've taken to both of these video game projects is I wanted to write something which to me felt faithful to the player experience, because that's where, you know, that's where people come into the world. And it's no good me kind of taking an overview of the game and saying, well, I'm going to do, you know, I think there's a mistake sometimes when writing video game fiction that you are telling the story of the game and you're not telling the story of the game, because if you're in a gaming environment with players, you're in a shared universe with them.
Right.
And I think what you need to do to be faithful to that kind of material is to tell a story that fits in within their universe and feels immediately familiar to their own experience of coming to the game, but actually doesn't try and take their experience away from them. So for Elite Escape Velocity, I wrote that very much from the point of view of, because I kind of, it was, that was written a little bit kind of by the seat of my pants. And I took that first episode as saying, I'm a pilot in a damaged ship. I'm kind of crashing onto this space station. Where do I go? You know, as a player, where do I go from there? What kinds of interactions with characters do I expect to have at that point? And how does that kick off a wider drama? So a lot of the stuff that happens very much in episode one, but certainly continuing a lot throughout the early episodes, is really taking cues from gameplay to drive the direction of the plot. And I think it's, you know, it does become, because as you say, you know, with something like a book, you've got that wider plot and you've got all the other characters. And I think if you are trying to create particularly an ensemble kind of cast, which is what I really wanted Escape Velocity to be over time, you're then looking at, well, how do I introduce other main characters into this when actually maybe the video game has you as kind of a solo entity, if you like.
So it would strike me as like one of your goals there is to capture moments that really capture the really feel of the game, if that makes sense. Like if it's a shooting game, you're going to want to have just an amazing like shooting sequence. If it's, you know, kind of a puzzle solving game, you'd expect to have some really cool kinds of puzzles show up, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. And I think like any adaptation, I'm sure we'll come on to this, you need to be sensitive to the kind of language that's already in use. Yeah. So where games have their own kind of internal naming conventions for things, it's very important that you use those and reproduce them. And, you know, so Elite historically had a whole bunch of different things associated with it. Certainly Frontier Elite 2, which is what I was more familiar with, had the concept of the bulletin board where you pick up jobs. You know, cargo is shipped around by the metric ton. Mm-hmm. There were certain types of goods that can be bought and sold at stations. And all of those things, getting those naming conventions right, even going so far as to kind of using the in-game world map as a kind of reference to navigation to say, well, look, you know, if they're going to jump from one system to another, if they're here, I can look at the game map and I can see all the places they can realistically get to. And it's that kind of thing. I think I think where films and things in the past that have tried to adapt video games have tried and failed is they've taken a very broad concept of what the game is and then just kind of thrown a pretty standard Hollywood screenplay at it. And I think gamers recognize something genuine and they recognize something that's written by someone that has an actual appreciation of a lot of the workings of the game world. And that's what I try and do. I try and keep it as faithful to the rules that are established by that game world as possible.
Yeah, that's one reason why I'm really excited and hopeful with the new World of Warcraft movie that's coming out fairly soon. Because, you know, that they spent so many years on that thing, they didn't rush it. So it's got to be something that I put a lot of effort into.
Yeah. Although, have you seen Realms of Fighting?
Uh-uh.
Have you come across that? Okay, so this is a YouTube show, and it's basically, it's a little animated thing, and it's about a guy who has uploaded his kind of entire life into an aging online role-playing game. And it's not an official World of Warcraft thing, but it is very much a pastiche of the World of Warcraft universe. And it's this little, I think they're up to maybe 6 or 7 episodes or something. And it's, you know, it's a pretty funny show. And I think a lot of people who, you know, play those kind of games would actually, I think they've done a really good job of parodying it in a kind of loving way.
So, but I mean, we also have the novel versions, the novel as a source material. It's not always Gaming Worlds. And so I'm trying to think of what some different source materials people have used before, because we've talked about games, we've talked about novels. I know we also have comic books going to audio drama as well. So it's each of those sources is going to have its different sets of issues and challenges, I guess I'd say.
I think I have the exact opposite problem that Chris has, is that you have this immense world in a video game. Everything is out there. It's already shared by the community. And with a novel, I'm kind of experiencing the limitation of having just one novel that's supposed to be representative of the same kind of scope. That there are going to be character arcs and story arcs to go on for years. And not all of that information is necessarily available to me to write the novel or write the adaptation of the novel. So I have to guess. I'm kind of in an Alan Dean Foster Splinter of the Mind's Eye kind of situation, mm-hmm. where I don't know what's going to happen between Star Wars and Empire, but I got to make stuff up. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that taking the novel, which would probably represent maybe 2 hours if we just did a linear adaptation by the book, and turn it into 6 hours of character development and plot development and trying to initiate readers to that world without either revealing too much or contradicting what's going to come down the road.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So you're trying to make about 6 hours worth?
Yeah. The structure of the novel itself doesn't lend itself to a linear interpretation. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do was break it out into what I recognize as the core plots throughout, and there are three human beings who are our surrogates or our perspective into this new world of demons who are on Earth. It's a contemporary Earth. Everything is the same except for the fact that we have demon exiles from another dimension who are infiltrating society, and they're fighting their own war with conspiracies and manipulation and all of that. The subterfuge of demons is not necessarily all that interesting if you don't know why they're doing it. So a lot of this initial novel attempt by Ed is to bring us into that world slowly and start a very long, slow burn mm-hmm. toward the final reveal. Unfortunately, as an adaptation, it doesn't lend itself to telling an audio drama story very well. So what I have to do is change the focus and develop the human characters out so that we have a kinetic force that drives us through. And then what can I say additional about these characters? What kind of relationships can I put them into that makes sense but doesn't contradict what's going to come after? And you know, those kind of things. It's kind of like playing chess with the intellectual property owner. You ask questions and they kind of go, well, maybe. write it and I'll let you know.
I see. So basically, you're having to come up with a lot of stuff rather than asking too much, and then he either approves it or says no.
That's probably the way it's going to be, yeah. And I think when I sat down with Dave and with Ed Greenwood, that was part of the issue, was how much of this do you really want to reveal now, and how much do you want to wait for additional novels? And, yeah. and it's difficult for even the creator to come up with that.
Yeah.
Because they're playing the long game. They're playing poker with the reader.
Yeah, well, it can feel a bit like one of those old movie sets, you know, where you're kind of, you're shooting a shot down a street. But actually, if you open one of the doors of the buildings, it's just a cardboard building front. And actually, if you want to kind of take your camera and move it somewhere else, suddenly mm-hmm. you find actually that detail isn't there. And I think there is that problem, I think, with books, if you're trying to flesh out a world, is sometimes the writer, you know, you don't always get that information from them. And if you're not in a position where you're writing a script and you're able to call up the author and say, you know, what do you think about this in terms of an expansion on what you've already said, you do have to invent a lot of it yourself. And I think a lot of it, you know, as audio drama producers, a lot of it comes down to how confident we feel adding to someone else's material, you know, when we're doing an adaptation, and how much you need to be as faithful to the source material as possible. I mean, we've all seen it done badly. If you look, you know, if you look at the sort of standard criticisms of something like the recent Hobbit trilogy, or even the previous Lord of the Rings trilogy, most of the criticisms that the fans of the books will be around where they've added stuff that just doesn't feel consistent with the book or doesn't feel necessary to retelling that story in a new format.
But I think a lot of that, and I was actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just about to bring up Lord of the Rings as an example, because I think one of the keys to adaptation is having the pacing right in the new medium, because if you do a literal translation, it's not going to work in most cases. So in Lord of the Rings, like, how many minutes or hours into it are you still going to be with Tom Bombadil before you actually get to the real the real stuff? Like, they cut that character out, not because it wasn't, you know, something that was important to the history of that book, but because it just was way too long without getting into any action yet. You couldn't have that so early in the book. You'd be halfway through the first movie and like, what the hell is this? The pacing wouldn't work.
I think so long as you're honoring the spirit and the voice of that piece, I think Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit trilogy kind of went overboard with it, but it was still in that voice. It was still, it still felt like I was in that world. I could have done without an hour of it, but okay. The NPR Star Wars, however, did it right, in my opinion. They took a primarily visual film and they added layers of character development and conflict that Lucas couldn't do. So you got the insight into what life was like on Alderaan and the political climate as the Empire was growing. And that's, and they did it in such a way that it was actually interesting. So it added to the mythology. And I think a lot of that was done outside of George Lucas's consent, or at least it was like, okay, this doesn't affect me down the road, so I don't care what you do. And I think that's what we need to do, is that value add for, if you've read the book, you really have no incentive to come to us. Or if you're content in the video game world, or if you're happy with that movie, we have to give you something that, that incentivizes your involvement. So there's got to be a deleted scene. There's got to be something about that character that you didn't know before.
I do have one gripe with that, though, is that I don't know that Star Wars was purely just... I when I think of Star Wars, I think one of the reasons it was so successful was incredible sound design.
Oh, I agree.
So that, I think that translation had an advantage there, because you have these iconic sounds to draw from.
Well, yeah, I mean, Ben Burtt, I mean, the whole sound design for Star Wars was, it won Oscar. So,
yeah.
And I think that it contributed greatly to the success of the film. However, you can't make a 2-hour audio drama about sound effects.
Yeah.
And running around and shooting things. the character, which would be cool, but the characterization is what was lacking in the film. If you just told somebody about Star Wars and told them the plot, it actually gets dull pretty quick. It's very derivative.
Yeah.
It's that kinetic energy that goes into the storytelling that it's very hard to translate running around and shooting things into a 10-minute conversation around a dinner table. But somehow Star Wars actually did that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you'd potentially, you know, if you were looking at something like that in a, from a purely audio point of view, I don't think I would, even though I might have a big climactic battle as the kind of the finale of a story, I don't know that I'd rely on the actual battle itself.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, very visual or practical, like that moment of you know, trying to fire the torpedoes into the hole. I don't know that I'd choose something like that as being the apex of the battle. I think actually from an audio point of view, something like Return of the Jedi is much stronger, where you've got the big space battle going on and that's what's driving the kind of story to a conclusion. But actually the drama that's taking place is the drama between Luke, Vader and the Emperor in the throne room. And actually, I think if I were to look at that whole thing from an audio point of view, you know, I would want something for the climax of the battle that involved, that is a key character turning point, rather than necessarily a physical or an action or you know, if you want to argue it, a visual point.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I mean, I'm not doing an adaptation, but I'm doing like a big ensemble show, and thinking about like those climactic moments. As soon as you just throw a whole bunch of characters into a really chaotic scene, it gets confusing really fast. So the kinds of story structure that you're putting there in there at the very beginning is going to be really important to having a satisfying end.
Mm-hmm. We had a great example of this in the Guji, Brian, where we had in later episodes this giant battle with these marauders. There were dozens of them, and then we had dozens of people on the other side, and they were throwing things back and forth. It got muddled rather quickly. And I don't think, as cool as those scenes ended up sounding, they didn't have the same impact as a simple conversation between your character and the lead, Ken Peters, who they were exchanging information. It was almost expository, but the performances were far more navigable, if you will.
Yeah.
Talking about years of things happening than just throwing a bunch of sound effects around.
I remember the years after. I remember Jo better after the Battle of Wishwell. She was different. She seemed very sad and somehow lost. And I know most people were like that, but in her, it seemed like her spirit was missing. She worked with a lot of us, stayed with the kids until little clusters of humanity started coming back. She made sure I got to a good family. The Shearers of Plymouth. I caught her once, staring up at the stars in the middle of the night. I was, I don't know, 6. I thought she was praying. But then I realized she was reciting a poem. And speaking to someone beyond the stars. I never knew who. But she was crying. Looking for someone who wasn't there.
Where'er he be, on water or on land, under pale suns, or climes that flames unfold, one of Christ's own, or of Cythera's band, shadowy beggar, or Croesus rich with gold, citizen, peasant, student, tramp, whate'er his little brain may be, alive or dead, man knows the fear of mystery everywhere, and peeps with trembling glances overhead. The heaven above, a strangling cavern wall, the lighted ceiling of a music hall, where every actor treads a bloody soil. The hermit's hope, the terror of the sot, the sky, the black lid of the mighty pot where the vast human generations boil. I learned that one, just like you asked, darling. I even think I finally understand it.
So I think you have two extremes. You have the epic battle that goes on that gets moved really quickly, but you also have the opposite, which is that long internal monologue or that internal conflict, which has no expression outside a main character.
Yeah, when you're not driven by visual, I think you're really driven by emotion. So I think that's what your climax needs to be, is some sort of emotional peak.
Right. And it's hard to convey when it's just narrative. Otherwise, it becomes an audiobook.
Yeah.
But in our case, where you have a character who's dealing with a lot of things inside and isn't expressing it, you have to make that compromise and bring another character from the outside and even invent a new character to sit down and have that conversation in order to make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree with you because I'm notoriously anti-narrator. I know there's a topic somewhere else to bring on the line about about use of narrators. And I think it's, you know, I'm not completely anti them. I think narrators are useful if you're using them as a framing device for your story. But I think actually all too often narrators get brought in, particularly for adaptations of novels, to cover what the writer doesn't feel they can dramatize in the script.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we're talking about adaptation, I think that's the one thing that I really try and not do, because really, if you're just using a narrator for free and cheap exposition, you're doing yourself a disservice and you're doing the piece a disservice. And I think there are always better ways of doing it. I mean, Alan Stroud's Lave Revolution novel, which is the Elite Dangerous, the book that is adapted. He has a tendency as a writer, he does quite often have extended scenes where characters are on their own, but that's just not I mean, when I came to those scenes, I had to take another look at it and say, I'll be honest about what I actually did. I actually just cut those scenes. And I looked, I just cut them out because there was a scene where one of the characters had been in like an isolation ward in a hospital, and then he'd been kind of released from his isolation, and he kind of starts wandering through this spaceport and is looking for a ship he can hire, and he's thinking about all his friends who've died and all these sorts of things. And I just couldn't do anything with it. But I think what I needed to do, because it's quite a densely plotted novel, is look at the information that is actually conveyed during that sequence and some of those emotional beats which mm-hmm. are conveyed during that sequence, and think, where else can these go? Are these, you know, are there other scenes that he's already in that we can drop some of this stuff into? Do I need to add additional scenes for him, you know, where he can have some interaction with somebody else and you bring some of this stuff out? And I really, you know, I mean, when I started adapting it, Alan said, I really don't think you're going to be able to do this without a narrator. And I said, I'm absolutely not using a narrator for it. So it's kind of a challenge, but I think it comes back to this thing of how faithful you need to be in order to adapt something. If you are literally just recreating it scene for scene, I think quite often with a book, you can't get away with not using a narrator, because if you can't bring different characters in or move things around or change the way information is conveyed, you know, that solo stuff of characters talking to themselves doesn't work for very long. And I think you need to do yourself a favor and basically look at those scenes and re-block them with additional characters.
You know, whenever a character is like describing what they're thinking out loud or like describing what they're holding or picking up and stuff like that, it 99% of the time it rips me right out.
Yeah. I hear that. You look at each scene as though, what is the purpose? I mean, every chapter that you write needs to move the plot forward, but that point is usually buried deep in a lot of flowery prose. And 9 times out of 10, a novel has a lot of space to physically move a character back and forth to do small things, when in reality, but we're also, from that framework, we're able to deviate a little bit left and right and add things that might otherwise enhance the experience. So I'm reading a couple of novels that a character physically moves from one place to another back and forth, and it's very repetitive, and there's symbolism to it, but the symbolism is lost in the medium. If I adapted that, I would have to take that journey out mm-hmm. and replace that symbolism somewhere else within a character, even a new character.
Yeah. I mean, we'd mentioned pacing, but what about sort of turning something like a novel into something that's episodic? I mean, you have to think of audio drama as episodes, right? Are you trying to have sort of a 3-act structure to each one, or are you just trying to have each thing end on something that will pull you into the next one, or is there any plan there?
Yes. I find that the lesson of reading audiobooks and getting feedback from people who read audiobooks is the more the plot jumps around, the less engaged they are.
Yeah.
If their focus is on the road or work or the project they're working on, if the more character arcs you add and the more concentrated they are, the less your listener's likely to get to the end of the book. So I using that lesson and applying it to the book that I'm working on, Your World is Doomed, was one of the reasons why I tried to extract each of the main plot arcs and follow that character through, just so that we're streamlining and keeping their attention. And I think you build a momentum. And if you break those characters down into their A, B, and C, or their act 1, 2, and 3, it's easier to keep the attention. It's easier to keep the plot moving at a rapid pace. And you could break that story into cliffhangers at the end of 1 and 2, mm-hmm. much easier than A, B, C, B, A, D, A, B, A as your sequence.
Yeah.
So, and it allows you to map out. If you start to extract actual chapters from the manuscript and start breaking them down into their own individual development arcs, it becomes easy to create a streamlined cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. How about and you, then Chris? Put it all together.
Yeah, I think I have similar experiences. I think one of the things I think maybe it's a challenge. One of the things I found difficult, because I think of audio drama as being episodic. And even if it wasn't, I really like an episodic format. I'm a massive Doctor Who fan. Mm-hmm. And I much prefer, there's a part of me that even prefers that old classic style of having, 25 minute episodes with kind of regular cliffhangers. Because I just love that. Mm-hmm. I just love that start and finish that an episode gives you. That said, I don't know. I mean, maybe after Lave Evolution has hopefully one day been finished and released, and I'll get some feedback from people, we'll discover how successful we were. But I found it not too difficult to come up with cliffhangers. One of the things that I was originally working on for it, because the requirement had previously been that it would be distributed on audio CD. So I was kind of thinking in my head, well, if it's going to go on a CD, I really want each CD's worth to be a kind of episode, a self-contained episode. I don't want to have something that cuts off in the kind of the middle of its flow before you then get to carry on the story. Do you know what I mean? I wanted that whole thing of sort of changing the disc or whatever. I wanted that to be a self-contained experience within itself on the disc. So I started thinking about the timing of the episodes in terms of CD length. And I personally didn't find it very difficult to organize the pacing, and not just the pacing, but the kind of the dramatic beats of actually getting those to build up to a cliffhanger or a conclusion at the end of an episode. What I think is more difficult is if you're trying to establish a proper structure within those episodes. So if you were to look at an episode and say, well, I want this to be, even regardless of the ongoing story, I want this to be a self-contained thing within itself. I think it's very hard to adapt a longer work into shorter episodes and then still make those episodes have a kind of beginning, middle, and end structure, because that's just not the way the original plot has been told. And I think you can do a certain amount with pacing. And I think that you can, certainly in terms of your sound direction and your music cues, you can shuffle things around. And I certainly found that one of the conversations I had with the original author was that when I was actually editing it into drama, I kind of said to him, I need to move some of these chapters around, because the order that you've written them in isn't helping me to hit the right kind of dramatic beats for the beginnings and ends of episodes. And I'm like, there's a huge battle here, and then actually in another character story arc, they're in the middle of a big fight as well. And I want to kind of put some space between those big dramatic moments. Mm-hmm. So, it's in terms of actually giving. I mean, like, just to give an example, if you're talking about giving a character their own kind of internal story arc over the course of an episode, that's very hard to do if that's not how the original thing is written. And if you're taking a single book and turning it into, as you were talking about, sort of 12 episodes or 6 episodes or whatever you're doing, does that character really go through 6 to 12 story arcs
right,
over the course of the original story? They don't. So I think that's much more of a challenge. If you're trying to push that kind of structure into it, I do think you need to look at it more in a kind of a serial way, not serial as in serial, but a serialized format where you are just telling a bigger story over the course of breaking it up into sections.
Well, I think another good topic is thinking about audience. Like, obviously with pacing, we're trying to, and climaxes and things like 3-act structure is trying to keep people engaged, right? Is there anything that you're really working to consider in terms of losing audience or in terms of bothering people? I think narrator was one. Some people may just dislike a narrator. I know in my case, I have a very strong opposition to audio dramas that have too many children in them, because usually it's not done well.
Sorry. I know very well your aversion to having kids.
And Jay and I have worked together, and Jay likes to write very complicated scenes with lots of screaming children in them, and every once in a while I would send him a text that would just say F you and your children, Jay, while I was trying to work on that scene.
I mean, I'm really torn, because I've obviously, I've grown up with, and I've listened to some really excellent audio dramas with kind of, I don't know if it's a young cast or adults doing a really good job of sounding like kids. Mm-hmm. And having kind of grown up listening to that, I do have some appreciation now of how difficult it is to create a drama with genuinely good sounding kind of young people in. I had a bit of a kind of, I sort of struck gold a bit with Escape Velocity because I cast a young actress who actually isn't all that young, but she's got quite a sort of, I don't know how to say it really without being rude, but she's kind of got a bit of a baby sort of voice. Mm-hmm. She sounds and looks a lot younger than she is. So I was able to kind of leverage that, mm-hmm. that confidence and that skill of an older actress, but actually still have her sound like a kind of early teen character. But yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And there are certain things that will just drive people away from, yeah, certain things in audio drama.
Well, I mean, it's about, like I said earlier, it's really about emotion. And if you have something where the acting just can't hold up, or someone's doing such an extreme voice that it's just distracting in order to sound young, like, it can really pull you out of that emotion because you just don't believe it. And it's just a challenge. I mean, there are definitely child actors in the world who have done a great job in certain things, but I think they're very hard to come by. And if you write that in, you're taking a risk that it'll actually come across the way that it is in your head.
It really depends on your talent pool. And I think my mistake was not considering the available pool of talent that works for free, that we had access to. But yeah, I learned my lesson is to make sure you have access to the people who can actually do the kind of work that you're asking. Because there were some characters beyond kids, you're just not going to get, especially if you have a satellite production or remote production with limited rehearsals, you're not going to get someone who's going to give you a nuanced performance that's necessary to carry off even an adult role. You're talking about monsters or immortal science fiction characters that have a very specific bent to them. You have to spend more time with them. And if you don't, in the early stages of a production, commit to one-on-one performance development with the actor or intense rehearsals, you're going to lose your listener to inauthentic performances.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge of any kind of, if we're talking about adaptation, is that you don't, when you're adapting something, I'm obviously not talking about video game adaptation because I guess I get to write whatever characters I kind of want to write within that. But certainly if you're adapting a book or if you're adapting a story from somewhere else, your characters are already kind of set for you. I mean, you couldn't, if you said, well, I'm going to make an audio drama of Sherlock Holmes, you can't do that and say, well, I don't really have an act, you know, I don't have an actor in mind that I think would be really good to be Sherlock.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll change Sherlock's character or not have Sherlock in it. And you kind of think, well, actually, no, if you're adapting that source material, you have to make sure that you have a talent pool that gives you actors that can hit those key parts. I mean, for something like Sherlock Holmes, you know, if you don't have someone that could play a good Moriarty, that's kind of fine because you can write around Moriarty and you can do stories that Moriarty's not in. But if you don't at least have a good Holmes and Watson, you're kind of a bit stuck.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to, because I mean, for me, I always try to, in my case, I mean, this is getting a little bit more towards production, but I'm writing an ensemble part, and you know, I try to cast and then write to the cast, which is not always sensible. But for me, like I'm not writing characters and then trying to find the person because I know my talent pool. I know who I trust and now who can do what, and I try to push the abilities of each actor. But that's kind of a unique case. When you're adapting something, you're really driven by the source material. Then you got to find the voices to fill it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I had a bit of a happy accident with Escape Velocity because I've always been very keen on trying to make sure there's a good mix of kind of male and female roles. And I'm very aware of kind of, particularly in a kind of sci-fi environment, things tend to get written very male heavy.
Right.
And I wanted to kind of redress that balance. And I actually ended up redressing it with Escape Velocity more than I expected to, because my cast were all drawn from a local amateur theatre that I'm a member of. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're I don't know what it's like for you guys in the States, but certainly in the UK, if you're a member of a local amateur theatre, probably 80% of your membership are female. And one of the things amateur theatres really struggle with is kind of male actors, male leads, particularly older male characters. So I actually ended up, you know, some of the characters in Escape Velocity were written for people that I specifically had in mind for those parts. An awful lot of the characters I just wrote in a very aspirational way and said, this is going to be this sort of character. Mm-hmm. And it actually meant that when I came to record it, I'd actually written a lot of the parts to be quite gender neutral. So when you've got like a scene where four kind of robo-suited special forces characters burst into a room and started shooting the place up, you know, three out of four of those soldiers were women because those were the actors that I had. And it's sort of, it's quite easy to take credit for it after the fact and say, oh yeah, you know, I just decided that in the 33rd century that, you know, special forces would be a complete mix of male and female characters. But actually there's a practical element to it that I ended up, even if in my head sometimes I'd written the character as male, I couldn't cast them as male because I just didn't have, the bodies in the studio, if you know what I mean, to do it.
Sure.
So it was kind of, in some respects, it ended up being a kind of opportunity. It was an opportunity for me to look at the writing and to have a really serious think about when I'd got characters in my head as being male, female, did I really need them to be the genders that I'd assigned? Or was I just kind of repeating tropes from other fantasy or science fiction things? And was I, you know, just perpetuating an idea that this is what male characters do in a story and this is what female characters do? So it can be helpful sometimes to have those kind of practical things pushed on you, even at the writing stage.
So this is a topic that I'm going to do as a whole different segment at some point, but I do want to ask you guys this question. In terms of writing these kinds of stories, are you doing a whole bunch in terms of writing of sound design, or is it mostly dialogue with very, very minimal sound direction?
I suppose it's difficult for me. It's difficult for me to judge in comparison to other people. Right. I do write a certain amount of sound design into the script where that sound design is kind of critical for really for the performance, I think. I do kind of take my script, I think, because I have the benefit of, I say benefit, because I write them and I then do the post-production and editing on them. Mm-hmm. I kind of don't need to be telling myself too much in the script what I'm expecting to hear at any given point. But if it's going to affect an actor's performance or I need them to bear a certain thing in mind.
Yeah, react to something, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do the kind of classic thing of, you know, there was a scene where a character was being interrogated in a cell and I very much wanted to have it that this last line from the interrogator was kind of, he was on his way out and he kind of turns and fires off this kind of parting shot.
Sure.
So I put in the script the cues for the kind of footsteps away and the door opening because I wanted that actor to be aware that I didn't want that line just kind of being run through. So, and there's certain other stuff. I think where if I'm planning something or writing something where I already know that the sound design is going to be critical. Again, if we're getting into space battle stuff, things like music cues, ambient sound effects at different places, because there's actually, I think there's a very different kind of background ambience you have if you're dealing with a scene that's more character driven and kind of emotionally driven than something which is maybe more of a transit scene or a battle scene. So I don't mind in a battle scene, you know, we'll have the engines on full, we'll have laser blasters going, we'll have radars pinging and all that sort of thing. But those two characters could be in exactly the same environment, in exactly the same room, having a different kind of conversation. And I might actually pull all of those kind of space setting kind of effects, pull those right out. So actually really all you've got is just two people talking in a room because that's your emotional focus. Mm-hmm. Rather than just saying they're in this room, therefore this is my soundscape. I tend to vary things depending on what's going on. So, but like I say, because I write my scripts and then I edit them, I'm probably not as prescriptive with the sound design stuff as I might otherwise be?
I think in my case, that was a major question about how to proceed with Your World is Doomed. Because when I read the book, I realized that Ed Greenwood is a writer for the senses. He's a dungeon master. He created Forgotten Realms for Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. So when he writes, his scenes are very much putting you in the moment. It's very sensory. He's engaging everything that he can. So when it comes to adapting it for audio, I don't want to compromise on that. It's economical and a hell of a lot easier to do what I call a sitcom environment, where the suspension of disbelief is there. You know, you're on a basic, simple soundstage with microphones and limited effects. But in order to achieve what was on the page, I decided that we needed to be a little bit more elaborate. We needed to do some live environment recordings, take people out, and make it sound like we're in that moment. If you're familiar with Stephen King's The Mist, the adaptation from many years ago, the point of that was to drop you into the action and make you feel like you're stuck in that grocery store with all the other characters being terrorized. And I think as the novel is a horror story, it's urban horror, it's urban fantasy, really. We need to have the listener involved and running down that alley with the protagonist with the sounds coming from behind them, approaching them. It's a lot more complex, but I think when an author goes to such an extent to engage all your senses, you have to preserve that in the adaptation somehow. So that was a major question that Dave Robison and Ed and I came to an agreement on. It's going to take a little bit longer, but I think the effect will be far more engaging than the traditional, let's stand around with microphones and record.
You know, everything's going to have its own style. It's hard to give totally general answers to all this stuff, but it's really worth thinking about. I mean, you know, adaptation, you're trying to stay true to some source material, so maybe you lose some flexibility there compared to just completely original, where you can do whatever you want. But it gives you advantages too, I would imagine. I mean, do you find that you like writing from somebody else's material? Because I know, Jay, you've done both for sure. Do you find that it's a fun challenge, or do you find that it's harder or easier?
It's harder in some ways. Clearly, it's easier because the plot's laid out for you.
Right.
that's, you know, writing HG World, you find yourself going, what the hell do I do next? But in this case, it's how do I, if I have to add material and I have to change things, how do I do that and sound like the author? How do I avoid taking the listener out of that moment with the narrative? And especially when the author has such a distinct voice, even identifiable within the dialogue, it's kind of like if you're adapting Aaron Sorkin, how the hell do you do that effectively? Or a David Mamet play. I mean, there's so many signature elements that the original author puts into it that sometimes you're just not worthy to blend that together. And you have to kind of punt and hope that whatever you put into it is worthy. That's really difficult. And then deciding without really knowing those mysteries that are coming down the pike, what you can change and what you can't, that's kind of frustrating, because you can have a great idea for how to consolidate three scenes into one and make it more interesting. But then you, in the back of your head, you're always wondering, if I lose that, is that going to kill something down the road? Or what's back that say, rewrite 50 pages because reasons, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's the challenge of collaborating with somebody else's final say.
I think from my point of view, I think in some respects, adaptation, however you look at it, there's elements of it that I really like, because if you're adapting source material, I mean, one of the horrible things, obviously, as a writer is that whole thing of staring at a blank page. And actually, if you're staring at a blank page and your world you're about to start writing is entirely your own and there are no walls, it can feel very big and very open. It's hard to know where to start. One of the things that's nice about an adaptation is you have a target to hit. I mean, if you're adapting a book into an audio drama, you know, you're judging your script that you're writing on the basis of how effectively am I adapting this source material? Do you know what I mean? So you've got a constant measuring post that you can kind of look at and say, this is working or this isn't working. Whereas actually, if you're just kind of pushing out and doing your own thing, you don't have any limitations. You don't have any restrictions other than the ones that you put on yourself. And that can be very unnerving. It's one of the things I like about writing fiction, you know, with the game adaptations, is that I'm creating my own characters and I'm creating my own stories and my own plots and my own message, I guess, that I want to bring within that drama. But actually, because I'm writing it within somebody else's world, there are just a few walls here and there. There are a few things that I know I have to keep within in order to keep that adaptation being kind of true and being kind of faithful. And actually, I personally find, as a writer, I actually like those restrictions. I like the complications that keep me going down a particular route, rather than just, you know, for the sake of argument, if I were to sit down and create a Lord of the Rings completely from scratch, that's such a huge and a big daunting thing. And it's one of the arguments I've had for years about, you know, people talk about fan fiction and whether fan fiction is kind of a good thing or a bad thing. And I always sort of say that actually I recommend fan fiction to anyone who is starting out as a writer. If you're just, you know, trying to think about writing your first few pieces or whatever, if you've got something that you really want to write some fan fiction about, I think that kind of adaptation is really valuable because it takes the pressure off you to build your world entirely yourself. Yeah. You know, writing fan fiction for someone else's thing gives you a whole load of stuff for free. When I was just getting back into writing a few years ago, and this was going back to the Machinima thing, I wrote a Doctor Who episode. And it wasn't because I wanted to reproduce anything that the show had already done. It was because I loved the character. I loved the rules and the kind of world and the format that was set up with the show. And actually, having taken those things out of the equation, it left me free to invent my own setting, my own story, my own subsidiary characters to come in. And it meant that I could focus on those things. Yeah, I didn't have to create everything. I just had to create my new stuff that I was bringing to it. So I will always say to new writers, if they feel a kind of pull to write some sort of fan fiction, I say go for it, because if you're just starting out, like I say, it's great to have. It's a little bit like having stabilizers on your bike. It just gives you one less thing to have to worry about when actually what you really need to be focusing on is writing good dialogue or coming up with good characters.
Sure. I think that can also teach you a bit if it's a series that you're very familiar with and you write it and then it gets produced, whether by you or someone else, you get a sense of how your page came to ear with sort of a reference frame of something that already exists.
Absolutely. So it's a good it's a good measuring stick, as I say.
Yeah. Well, cool. I feel like we've put in a good hour or so. I feel like we could talk a long, long time on this topic because it's really fascinating, and both of you are really deep into this topic as well. So we got plenty that we could say. Are there any final thoughts that you wanted to bring into the topic of adaptation? Start with Chris, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that it's a difficult one, because I'd say that it's about being faithful to the source material, and it's about creating something that is genuine. And if you're adapting something that obviously your audience already know, you have to create something that feels authentic to them. And if that's, you know, if that's a greatly cherished book, I mean, there's lots of old novels which are kind of coming into public domain now because they're so old. You know, adapting those obviously requires a very delicate touch and a very faithful reconstruction of what's going on. But I think at the same time, you have to look at your audience that are coming to it with audio drama. And I think it's fair to say, you've talked about this on the podcast before, that we have now, in many circles, quite a sophisticated audience for audio drama. And that means, you know, you can adapt things properly and you can look at things and say, well, look, you know, I need to, as a writer, as a director, I need to make some creative changes in order to bring this properly to life in audio drama. And I think if I'd say anything in summary, it's probably A, have the confidence to do that, have the confidence in your writing and in your production, that you are going to be able to do that successfully. And B, if you can have a relationship with the original author or the creators of the original source material, that's a wonderful thing, because it gives you a sounding board for everything that you need to invent in order to bring their story to life in a new medium.
Awesome. How about you, Jay? How would you summarize?
I think it's a great opportunity to play in someone's established world. It's a responsibility. But as a writer, you can create your own original work, and you can hope that it becomes its own great thing. But being able to expand in somebody's established world, let's say, for example, we have mutual friends who write tie-in fiction for Star Trek and Star Wars. Being able to play in that playground and add to the canon or even headcanon is a fantastic experience. And it enriches you as a writer, because you're paying attention to things that you wouldn't normally pay attention to in your own fiction. And you have a sense that there's more than just your particular listeners who have a sense of entitlement to the product that you're creating. You're going to be presenting to a room of people who are going to present you with a level or a body of standards, a rubric, if you will, that you have no idea how to meet. So it's going to be an interesting journey to do that, but it's also, I think, a privilege and a great adventure.
Well, I want to wish you both best of luck with your projects. I'm excited to hear what comes out of both of you guys. Why don't we wrap up with letting people know where they can go to find your stuff? Why don't you go first, Jay?
You can find HG World 3 seasons worth of audio drama, about, I think, 10 hours worth of entertainment for free at goodmorningsurvivors.com. Brian and I worked on a pulp adventure series called Hidden Harbor Mysteries, which is also available from hiddenharbormysteries.com. And you can check out Under Librem for Ed Greenwood's adventures in 15 different worlds, underlibrum.com.
Cool. And Chris?
I have a website, which is radiotheaterworkshop.com. For my American cousins, don't forget that's Radio Theater, spelt the European way. and that's kind of, you know, I've got Facebook pages, I've got Twitter, I've got the Patreon, I've got the Kickstarter, but that you'll find everything through that one site. So that's got Escape Velocity on it, and it's got the current projects that I'm working on and bringing to fruition just at the moment.
Great. Thank you very much. Hope people enjoy this topic.